From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because life and truth matter. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man, we pick up where we ended on our previous broadcast and present more of an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast, in which Hank talked with Dr. Patrick J. Michaels, who has served as director of the Center for the Study of Science at the Cato Institute and president of the American Association of State Climatologists. Let's now join Hank Hanegraaff and Dr. Patrick Michaels in their conversation.
When you read headlines in USA Today, like CO2 levels are the highest in human history, higher than at any time in 800,000 years, higher than before the time that modern humans came into existence, that carbon dioxide has reached levels in our atmosphere not seen in 3 million years and so forth. Very, very difficult for the average person to process. And at some point in time, I suppose what you're saying is true, the baloney detector goes off and they're saying, yeah, I'm not believing any of this.
Yeah, that does happen. I mean, if you want to see, climate change that's fairly significant, you can go to the high-latitude land areas of the Northern Hemisphere. They've warmed up a fair amount. But most of the rest of the planet, not so much, and mainly, again, in the cold seasons, in the winter and at night. It's very hard to melt Antarctica by warming up the night, because at nighttime temperatures there, remember, Antarctica, most of it is below the Antarctic Circle, so there's perpetual night. Very long nights as you get closer and closer to the South Pole. And warming that up, you're never going to get it to above freezing. I can tell you that. Antarctica is this gigantic mass of ice. People do not realize how big it is. And it's really, really stable. It began to form, by the way, when the CO2 concentration in the atmosphere was quite a bit higher than it is today.
What are the motivations involved in all of that? I know that it's difficult to parse that out, but is this about people sitting in a smoky room somewhere saying we're going to find a way to garner a program that confiscates tens of trillions of dollars of the global economy? Or how does a narrative like this come into existence?
Well, in some cases, what you say, people sitting around a smoky room and saying that's what they really want to do, that does happen. The folks at the UN who put together the so-called Agenda 21, which really is a roadmap to do exactly what you're talking about, they did consciously do so. And then there are also people who, everybody likes to think that they're saving the world, whether the world needs saving or not, and therefore being concerned about global warming, and I'll use global warming rather than climate change, because all the things that happen as a result of the changes in carbon dioxide that are feared or not feared, all those things are a result of the warming of the lower atmosphere. So let's keep our eye on the ball. Anyway, people use global warming as virtue signaling. If they care about it, and if they besmirch anybody who doesn't agree with them, they think they're virtue signaling. This is really a very modern secular religion, unfortunately, with many of the intolerances that seem to come with some religions.
And there are stakeholder interests and incentives. There's motivated blindness, which inhibits a person's ability to perceive inconvenient data. There's shoddy research. And then you have the water carriers in the media that are putting forth that shoddy research as though it's well-established scientific consensus and so forth. So you have all those sociological factors as well.
And but you have people not asking simple critical questions. I always like it whenever I read a news story or hear one that says that global warming is going to increase mental illness. Well, I guess that's a very testable thing. Instead of having the planet warm, let's move the people to a warmer place. When they move from New York to Miami, do they go nuts? Does their mental health decline? Apparently not. So these glib pronouncements can be so easily tested with a little bit of logic. And the fact that some of the media figures in this seem to function more in a data-free and fat-free environment than they should.
You're talking about the virtue signaling as well, but if you think about this, what's going on right now, if in fact these policies get implemented, is really going to help the people that are rich and hurt the people that are poor. I mean, if energy costs increase, it's not going to hurt rich people, it's going to hurt poor people. And not only that, if you start spending tens of trillions of dollars of the global economy on this issue, it takes your eye off the ball. For $200 billion, you can provide fresh water for people that don't have it now. So you start funneling money in bad directions.
Yes, that is true. And as you say, rich people are not nearly as affected by it as poor people. And by extension, what these policies do is they limit poor nations, condemn them to underdevelopment, to poverty, all the things that we think are not so good, and do it in the name of virtue signaling for the developed world. Not a very good idea, if you ask me.
Talk about consensus science for a moment. So often you have these consensus claims that get bundled together.
Oh, the 97% of scientists agree that this is a horrible issue or something like that.
Yeah.
You hear that one all the time. And a wise friend of mine, Dr. Terence Keeley, who was president of a university over there in the United Kingdom, and we've worked together a fair amount, once observed that in virtually anything, 97% of scientists agree. You know, was it 20 years ago, 97% of medical scientists agreed babies should sleep on their backs or sleep on their stomachs, whatever it is, and 5 years later, that changed completely. And now babies, 97% of people agree that babies should sleep in the opposite direction, if you will, that 97% of scientists thought they should just a few years earlier. That's because scientists like to go along. I mean, if you disagree with a paradigm in science, if you disagree with a large majority of view, you're not going to have a very good time, and you're going to be attacked a lot. So really, there's a big herd instinct in science that most of the public is not generally aware of, but happens to be true.
There is a herd instinct. There's no question about that. I mean, that's happened throughout human history.
Yep, it has. That's correct.
Absolutely. And then you have the ad hominem attacks that you alluded to, the most famous of which is that if you don't believe in climate change or global warming, you're relegated to the status of a Holocaust denier.
Exactly. And that's, you know, I find that really disgusting because there's clearly fairly strong evidence that this issue is quite overblown.
And scientists are pressured, aren't they, to toe the party line because you have tenure and job promotions and government grants.
Yeah, you only get that if you publish a lot of research. And, for example, in climate science, there's only one supporter of that research. That's the federal government. So if you write a grant proposal that says, I want to be funded because I think this issue is overblown, you're going to get denied. Because the people that review that proposal are all the people that are in the funding stream. That's how they got the expertise to be able to review the proposal.
I saw you on Mark Levin's broadcast talking about the fact that we need another special counsel because the only climate models that correspond to reality happen to be Russian climate models.
Yes.
Tongue in cheek, obviously.
Obviously, yeah. But you can plot out the models and compare them to observations. And what you see, again, is that all of them except one group, which is the Russian model, are dramatically over-predicting warming. The Russian model's really good. And if we were using what I'd call best scientific practice, well, what we would do is we wouldn't take all 32 model families, average them up, and do the uncertainty of the model by the spread of the 32 model results. No, you would take what a weather forecaster does every day. They take the model that appears to be working in the recent past or in the weather forecast problem that's up for today. You don't average them all up. And so if we were following best scientific practice for the climate forecast, the same best scientific practice that's used on the weather forecast, we would be using the Russian model INMCM4. There is a revision of that that is slowly leaking into the literature, not surprisingly, INMCM5. And the one thing that I have noticed about it is it picks up the so-called pause in warming from roughly year 2000 to year 2014. That pause was a real embarrassment to the modeling community, and so the response of the scientific community, the bigwigs in it, was to change the data, not to change the models. And the world temperature records were revised with a method that was guaranteed to put some warming in that period where there wasn't much, if any. Now the Russian model comes out and indeed simulates the same pause that was observed.
Don't go away. In just a few moments, we'll rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Dr. Patrick Michaels. Winston Churchill once declared, "You may have to fight when there is no hope of victory, because it is better to perish than to live as slaves." Churchill sought to awaken those who were reluctant to fight against the advancing Nazi war machine. Today, a spiritual battle is raging as secularism and the iron boot of LGBTQ activism advances, with mass harm caused to young people by transgenderism and a corresponding decline in our religious liberties. Slavery to secularity is imprisoning more and more hearts and minds. For this reason, CRI's ministry is critical, but we need people willing to stand for truth, along with the financial provisions to accomplish its mission. Stand with Hank Hanegraaff and the Christian Research Institute during the key month of June to end the fiscal year in a position of strength. Call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. Equip.org. Bertrand Russell famously said, "Most people would rather die than think, and many of them do." Not so with CRI support team members. Support team members are not only serious thinkers, but their membership in CRI's support team helps to equip hundreds of thousands of fellow believers around the globe each and every month. Are you not a member? Then you're missing out. Not only do support team members form the backbone of Christian Research Institute's outreaches, but they enjoy their selection of resources from our Equipping Essentials library and receive a complimentary subscription to CRI's award-winning Christian Research Journal, just two of the benefits of membership. To discover how you can make a difference 24/7 in equipping believers at home and abroad to stand for life and truth, check out the benefits of membership at equip.org. Dr. Eben Alexander's wildly popular near-death experience book, Proof of Heaven, assures us that no matter what we do in this life, only unconditional love and joy await us in the world to come. But our Lord warned that while the gate to hell is wide, the road to it broad, and those who enter through it are many, the gate is narrow and the way is hard that leads to life, and those who find it are few. Your generous support lets Hank Hanegraaff and CRI speak out against the lies that lead to hell. In appreciation for your gift today, we'll rush you Hank's book, Afterlife, What You Need to Know About Heaven, the Hereafter, and Near-Death Experiences, filled with answers to your questions about life after death. Call 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org now. Again, that's equip.org. So rapid and pandemic has been the decline of biblical literacy and spiritual discernment that our once unimaginable post-truth culture is effectively becoming an anti-truth culture. While the sun is setting on the Western Church, Islam is now the fastest growing religion in the world. This means that it's not simply enough to be aware of this threat. Christians need to wake up, stand up, and speak up. This means being able to counter the outright lies about Islam that otherwise will go unchecked with horrendous consequences. And that's what Hank Hanegraaff's book, Muslim, What You Need to Know About the World's Fastest Growing Religion, will enable you to do. To receive your copy as our appreciation for your financial partnership, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's many outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. let's rejoin Hank Hanegraaff and Dr. Patrick Michaels in their conversation.
What about human activity? Is human activity a major part of the equation?
Well, it's a significant part, but it's not the only thing that's going on. I mean, we have the warming. The rate of warming in the early 20th century is much different than the rate of warming in the later 20th century, but we hadn't put enough CO2 in the air to cause that warming in the early 20th century.
If, in fact, we did everything, let's say, that the Paris Accords or the Kyoto Protocol demanded, if every single country, including China and India, complied, would that solve the problem?
If they did what they said they were going to do, no. No. It would probably reduce warming to the year 2100 by about 0.4 of a degree Celsius. So, no, that's not it. But the Paris Agreement is a joke anyway. It's not enforceable. There's no enforcement mechanism. Each country...
Unless you shame the countries.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's get to that in a second. No, you could put in your own goals. It was like, it's like writing your own final exam, okay, with the book in front of you. So the Indian pledge, if you will, the people of India, the government of India said, well, as you know, as economies develop, they actually become more efficient. They generally use lower carbon dioxide emissions either per capita or per unit economic output. That's called the emissions intensity of carbon dioxide. It drops naturally as the efficiencies of a large-scale economy come into play. The Indians pledged to reduce their emissions intensity at a rate lower than it was being reduced naturally. In other words, they purposely pledged to emit more per unit GDP than they would have if they just left things alone. The Chinese, that was a great breakthrough. You may recall, they said that they were going to attempt to, that's my words, they were going to attempt to stabilize their emissions around the year 2030. Well, there are several papers that came out years before the Chinese made that so-called commitment that predicted that because of the simple process of economic maturation, Chinese emissions are probably going to stabilize around the year 2030. So they agreed to do something that the experts pretty much suspected was going to happen if they did nothing. And the United States, on the other hand, does something that's quite tangible. And we reduce our emissions, gross emissions of carbon dioxide, more than any other large industrialized nation on Earth since 2005. And then we get out of the Paris Agreement because it was irrelevant to those emissions reductions. And I think that the president had a very good point that the agreement was unfair, that it, he didn't come out and say this, but that it allowed countries like India and China just to pull the wool over everybody's eyes, and everybody would clap their hands and say, oh, look, even the Indians and the Chinese are going along when they agreed to do absolutely nothing. So, yeah, the Paris Agreement's a joke.
Let me ask you a politically incorrect question. Is warming actually bad overall? In other words, if there's a slight warming trend, is that bad? That's sort of in concert with asking the question about CO2. I mean, CO2 is plant food. It creates longer growing seasons, the greening of the planet, and so forth. So it's not necessarily bad. I mean, too much CO2 is obviously bad, but is a little warming actually bad overall?
Well, there are some econometric models that suggest that warming up to about 2 degrees Celsius, maybe even a little bit more than that, in general is a net benefit. You know, we weren't given the best of all possible climates when we had the Industrial Revolution. We had a climate that probably was a little cold for climates since the end of the Ice Age, which would be for the last about 11,000 years or so. And so, yeah, it's quite possible that a little warming is okay. I mean, the fact of the matter is, when people are at the end of their professionally productive lives and they want to retire or go somewhere, they don't go to Greenland. They go to where it's warmer. And I think that says something about what human beings really want.
And we've already talked about this, but maybe a little bit of elaboration would be helpful. Suppose it is warming. Suppose we are causing it, so we're conceding to a number of the propositions within the narrative. Let's suppose it's bad. Would implementing any of the policies around today make a difference, or would the cost exceed the benefit?
No. You have to have a replacement source of dense energy. And for some reason, the same people that are so concerned about carbon dioxide emissions and global warming, a large percent of that community seems to be adamantly opposed to the only really viable dense energy alternative, which is nuclear fission. And, you know, they watch too many horror movies. I've been watching the HBO series Chernobyl. I don't know if you are you aware of this one?
Yeah.
I think it's really well done. Don't get me wrong. But that's the propaganda film that's going to have the same effect as the propaganda film the China Syndrome had in the late 1970s. You do know that Three Mile Island, one of the reactors at Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania, had a slight meltdown.
I do,
I believe it was in 79. It's the same day, this is such an ironic thing, the same day that the largest deposit of uranium in the United States was discovered. And if I tell you where it is, you won't believe it. You think it's out west. You think it's in the mountains. No, it's along the Virginia-North Carolina border near in Pennsylvania County, down by the state line there. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I'm telling you that, among other things, that's an indication that we have quite a bit of fuel for these machines. We really want to put them out there and have a source of electricity that is very dense, very concentrated, and doesn't emit any carbon dioxide to speak of. And so if you're all concerned about this issue, and you, for some reason, are adamantly opposed to nuclear, I will say in my own mind, this guy's not serious. He's got an ulterior motive, because if he were serious, he'd do that.
Talk a little bit about your book, Scientocracy. I'm really interested in the debut of that book.
Yeah, it's due to come out the first week in November. It's a book that talks about the unintended consequences, or maybe they are intended, I don't know, of the way that we reward and fund scientists, and how that results in these bandwagons, you know, these 97% deals, some of which are horrifically wrong. And one of the sections of the book is on regulation of carcinogens, ionizing radiation, and chemicals. And the model that's used is just wrong. It says that the first molecule of a carcinogen, or the first photon of ionizing radiation, is just as capable of causing cancer as the bajillionth one, because of their propensity to break strands of DNA. Well, the fact of the matter is, we are surrounded by electromagnetic radiation, and it's probably breaking DNA strands all the time. Since this standard was put out, it was in the process of being discovered that we have our own self-repair mechanism for DNA, and it's only when that gets overwhelmed by really large amounts of radiation that trouble begins to set in. So the entire paradigm for regulation of all the things around us, all the ionizing radiation, chemicals, carcinogens, you name it, is wrong. This guy by the name of Edward Calabrese from the University of Massachusetts School of Public Health has torn this thing apart. He has gone into the declassified records of the Atomic Energy Commission radiation panels and discovered that they knew that this whole standard, which is called the linearity, no threshold standard, was wrong. They knew it was wrong at the time. But you know why they did it? And Calabrese would come out and say this, but I know. That came out, that concept was developed during the era of atmospheric testing of nuclear weapons. And everybody's afraid of fallout, you know, it's going to cause cancer because strontium-90, strontium's in the same column of the periodic table as calcium is, and so it gets picked up just like calcium gets picked up out of milk. It will get picked up out of milk. And this is horrible. And I think these guys thought, if we frighten everybody and say that, you know, unless you stop these small amounts of radiation that are dispersing worldwide, unless you stop that, everybody's going to die, or there's going to be a dramatic increase in cancer. They were doing something they thought was virtuous. They were exaggerating for the greater good. And how many issues does that happen in, huh? Think about, okay, climate change. How about high carbohydrate, low-fat diets? How's that work out? seems to correlate with the development of a large amount of diabetes in the United States and the countries that adopted it. The people that put that out, they weren't trying to kill people. They thought they were doing good. They wouldn't accept other points of view, but they thought they were doing good.
Well, I appreciate the time you spent with us. It was very informative. Thank you. Thanks for tuning in. Look forward to seeing you next time with more of Hank Unplugged.
Thank you for listening to this special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. To hear this Hank Unplugged podcast interview with Dr. Patrick Michaels in its entirety, go to equip.org, iTunes, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. June is one of the most important months for the Bible Answer Man broadcast. That's because we close out another financial year, and we can do so successfully only if listening friends like you stand with us prayerfully and financially. With your gift in these final days of June, you'll help the Christian Research Institute impact even more lives with God's truth and equip Christians as authentic disciples of Christ. Please call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI. You can also write CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, 28271, or simply visit online at equip.org. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded solely by listeners like you. We're on the air because life and truth matter. Anyone who's been paying attention knows there's a war going on, not just on traditional morality, civility, and decency, but even more fundamentally on historic notions of truth. And the enemy isn't just the onslaught of fake news facilitated by a post-truth culture and turbocharged by growing legions of ideological spin doctors. No, the real enemies of truth range from postmodernist convictions that there is no objective truth to militant scientism that claims that only science can determine truth, and religion is little more than primitive superstitions. But CRI support team members are not waving a white flag of surrender. They're holding the fort by undergirding every one of Christian Research Institute's mind-shaping and life-changing outreaches 24/7. To learn how you can make a difference and enjoy all the benefits of support team membership, simply visit equip.org.